From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're learning more now about the man who's accused of carrying out that terrorist truck attack in New York yesterday. NYPD's Deputy Commissioner John Miller told reporters this morning he believes he was inspired by the Islamic State and had been planning the attack for weeks.
He appears to have followed almost exactly to a T the instructions that ISIS has put out in its social media channels before, with instructions to their followers on how to carry out such an attack.
The man driving the Home Depot rental truck is a legal permanent U.S. resident from Uzbekistan. This morning, President Trump tweeted out, "The terrorist came into our country through what is called the Diversity Visa Lottery Program, a Chuck Schumer beauty. I want merit-based." Let's bring in NPR's Hansi Lo Wang. He's in New York. And Hansi, start there. President Trump blaming this Diversity Visa Lottery Program. It's for people who come from countries with low immigration to the U.S. It's said to balance the immigration to the U.S. But the State Department and FBI aren't saying whether he had a visa from this program. So do we know? And by the way, is that program less vetted than other visa programs?
That's right. Well, let's start with we do not have any confirmation whether or not the suspect in the New York attacks was part of this visa lottery, diversity visa lottery. I spoke with the State Department and also the FBI and the NYPD. They would not confirm. The State Department says all visa applications are subject to privacy laws, and so they cannot speak to any individual visa applications. And in regards to this diversity visa lottery, it's something that certainly we do need to look into more about whether the security concerns are there.
Okay. Well, we know from in that press conference, we also heard from investigators that they will likely be at the scene throughout the evening gathering evidence, but have already found a letter inside the rented truck with references to the Islamic State. What else do we know about the letter and about the attacker?
Well, as far as we know, the NYPD says that this was a note that essentially said in Arabic, a handwritten note said, "As the Islamic State would endure forever." That's how John Miller of the NYPD summarized that note. And this is they're seeing as indication. One of the pieces of evidence they're citing to say that why they think this suspect was inspired by ISIS to carry out this attack.
Yeah. NYPD's Deputy Commissioner John Miller also said yesterday that police have been speaking with truck rental businesses, also hardware stores, but truck rental businesses over the past year. Miller told reporters the industry has a high level of awareness on how to identify people who are plotting something like this. Do we know what they would say? I mean, how do you screen people renting trucks?
That's a really good question. But so far, John Miller said that their conversations with these truck rental companies so far hasn't shown anything unusual happened over the past few days, anything that related to the attack so far. The investigation, of course, is still ongoing. We do know that the NYPD is very sensitive to, you know, this type of attack. This style of attack has been announced on social media by ISIS for a while now. And so the NYPD is trying to be proactive about it in major events, including the New York City Marathon this weekend. They will be having these sand-filled dump trucks along routes in front of major buildings to try to help protect the crowds that will obviously gather.
And we've been seeing those at most big city events. Well, Senator Lindsey Graham is calling for the suspect to be held as an enemy combatant. We remember he was shot by a New York City policeman yesterday after he ran from the truck and operated on, and he is being held. Graham wants him to be held as an enemy combatant, and we understand for one thing that means he can be questioned without a lawyer. What else does that mean?
Well, as far as I know, I think that would be the main issue here that Senator Graham is trying, why he is calling for this, in order to get additional information from the suspect and to learn more about what exactly he was planning and why he was planning it. NYPD says this was in the works for weeks. And so there's a lot of information possibly to be learned from the suspect. And Senator Graham thinks that without a lawyer present, there may be more information that could be gathered. However, it's unclear. Senator Graham has called for this. It's unclear what will happen next.
Mayor de Blasio said today the attack wouldn't deter New Yorkers. Let's listen.
And I'll tell you, this violence was an effort to make us blink, and we won't blink. We won't change.
What does it feel like there in New York, Hansi?
You know, last night I was walking around near the scene, and a very surreal moment because it was Halloween night. And so folks who lived in that lower Manhattan neighborhood in Tribeca were wandering around the police tape, little children with their pumpkin candy holders and dressed up in different costumes. Simultaneously, NYPD officers were still around, police cars flashing, still investigating the scene. And so, I think a lot of New Yorkers are still in shock and coming to grips with, what does this mean and how do you move forward with so many public events coming up, including the New York City Marathon just this Saturday.
NPR's Hans-Ayala Wang in New York. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, breaking news here at NPR. The senior vice president of news, Michael Oreskes, said today he is resigning following sexual harassment allegations. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And David, these allegations were made public in the Washington Post just yesterday. Then you reported on a current NPR employee who had filed a complaint against Oreskes 2 years ago. NPR put Oreskes on leave yesterday, and now we have the news that he's resigning.
That's right. And let's offer for the first time some additional insight and details into what played out. The two accusations that were first revealed in the Washington Post involved two women who were seeking job opportunities and advancement at the New York Times, where Oreskes was the Washington bureau chief, very powerful figure nearly two decades ago. They talked about being forcibly pressed by him, kissed by him, unsolicited, undesired, and that he put his tongue in their mouths in each separate instance, very similar tracking anecdotes. We had thought that NPR had first learned about these two things in mid-October. Let's do a timeline. NPR first received – Mike Oreskes joined NPR in spring of 2015. In fall of 2015, a young colleague of ours, Rebecca Hersher, complained of a dinner that was supposed to be an afternoon meeting that became a long and winding personal conversation that made her feel deeply uncomfortable and question herself. She complained he was warned and told that same month that he had behaved inappropriately. He was formally reprimanded, and that's what we knew. Well, it turns out a year ago that NPR found out from one of the women now alleging that she was essentially sexually harassed when he was at the New York Times, that they knew about this in October of 2016 and that Mike was talked to, but that no additional action was taken, it appears, because that involvement had – or interaction had occurred prior to his time at NPR and prior to his formal rebuke in 2015. Then a second woman came forward in 2016 alleging these accusations of what happened at the New York Times back nearly two decades ago. And at that point, Jarl Mohn, our CEO, put out a memo to staff saying anybody who knows anything or who has been in any way sexually harassed should come forward, placing it not unreasonably in the context of all that has played out in these other media organizations at Fox News, Harvey Weinstein at Miramax, and many other media figures, but actually with the purpose of trying to flush out and see if there were other women willing to come forward to say that they had felt personally harassed. I am told by NPR that no women did so. And then working behind the scenes, they claimed that this was not forced by the Post's publication of the story, but by their own processes that they finally led to putting Mike Oreskes on leave yesterday. Of course, a lot of people now are saying, well, it seems as though they only did so because of the publication that these facts were made public.
Have we gotten any reaction from NPR leadership about his resignation today?
Jarl Mohn put out a statement to staff saying that, it's important for them to understand that NPR has had to preserve certain kinds of confidentiality, even while they say actively pursuing facts and actively pursuing remedies for these actions. He also stressed the importance of an inclusive workplace, of an affirming workplace, a place where people can do work without consideration of how they felt their boss was thinking about them. In this case, how a very senior male executive was thinking about female colleagues. And let me say that in talking to women, both in reporting on Rebecca Hersher's experience, which I first started doing about 18 months ago, and more recently in recent days, that women have said that they felt that Mike's Oreskes' presence in some ways infused the newsroom with a toxic. and that there was a poisoning to the newsroom because they didn't trust themselves in his presence alone, and that even if in some ways some of these aspersions being cast were unfair, it very much affected their thinking about his leadership, and that it compromised him. At this point, most women I talked to within NPR don't think that these aspersions were unfair at all. They think there was a pattern, and they now question why NPR didn't act more precipitously and earlier.
He came in, as you said, just a couple of years ago to NPR, and I was looking back at your story about him at the time, and he was characterized by people who had worked with him at the AP and at the Times as a sharp and tough executive. Do we know who will take over the NPR newsroom now?
Well, Chris Turpin, a very experienced broadcast veteran, a guy who led All Things Considered with distinction at the network and has been Oreskes' number two. He will be the acting news chief for the network, and he served in that role prior to Oreskes' selection and involvement here from the AP in 2015.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who's been doing great reporting on a difficult story to cover over the last day or so. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
For 20 years, Dr. Thomas Andrew has been chief medical examiner in New Hampshire, a foot soldier on the front lines of the opioid epidemic. Last year, New Hampshire had 500 opioid-related deaths. Dr. Andrew and his deputy, Dr. Jenny Duval, each performed 250 autopsies. By law, that's the limit per examiner. Any more, and a state can lose accreditation. But what about the other deaths in the state? New Hampshire officials say they'll hire another pathologist and then replace Dr. Andrew as well because he's about to enter divinity school to minister to addicts before they get to his cold steel table. Dr. Thomas Andrew joins us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you are in the process of leaving. You still have open cases that you're dealing with. How can you describe to us how overwhelmed your office is?
Well, when I first started in 1997, this was a state that saw 30 to 40 drug deaths a year. When you're seeing 500 drug deaths a year and your national accrediting body says, by way of an autopsy standard, that any known or suspected drug overdose deaths shall be autopsied, the numbers just don't add up. Because if we were to do all of our drug overdose cases and reach our limit of autopsies per pathologist, how would the homicides get done? How would the traffic crashes get done? How would the suicides get done?
Well, you're not allowed to refuse to do them. And as we said, the state says they're going to bring in a third coroner. But are you still worried? You're leaving. Other states have lost accreditation because of the opioid epidemic.
Well, that was certainly a possibility for us. What I am happy to report is that we were awarded full accreditation on the basis of our most recent inspection. Our inspector was convinced that we, in good faith, were addressing our numbers issue, that the quality of our work product was exemplary in every other way, and so we were awarded full accreditation with the proviso that they're going to check on us again in a year to see if we made good on our promise to get this problem addressed.
Yeah.
We now have two open positions.
Okay, that brings us to another problem. So you're going to be leaving. Your deputy, Jenny Duval, becomes the chief. You're looking now for two more forensic pathologists, but there aren't that many of them. This is not a field that people are going into.
There's the rub, isn't it?
Yeah.
Only 27 young people this year took the certifying examination for forensic pathology. So the applicant pool is very small. And in the face of the opiate crisis, the jobs are multiplying like so many mushrooms after the rain. I just got back from Scottsdale, Arizona, where we had our National Association of Medical Examiners meeting to try and recruit, to talk up our jobs and our positions and life here in New Hampshire. And I found to my horror that we are up against many, many, many jurisdictions who are now hiring because they've added staff to respond to this.
Chris, something. And talk a little bit more about the work itself. This isn't neat and tidy the way it is on CSI, from my understanding.
Well, like many things in life, there are seasons in the life of a forensic pathologist. At least that's been my experience. very early in one's career, I think you find out whether or not you are hardwired to do this for 20, 25, 30 years. And many people wash out quite early. Those who can go into that next season of their forensic life when they are developing their craft, and they develop with that a fair amount of swag. I've seen everything, I've done everything, nothing can faze me now. And that's a dangerous place to be, because if you completely shut out the humanity that's on the table in front of you, I don't think you can effectively minister to the families who are left behind when you make that phone call after the autopsy to explain to them the findings and give them some sense as to what's going on. And I didn't use the word minister by accident.
I know. I was just thinking you are going into a ministry, but you have already been a minister.
There was a seminal article in our field. It was written way back in the 1950s by Lester Adelson, and it was called Forensic Pathologist, Family Physician to the Bereaved. I take that very seriously.
So there's that, burden or honor.
Well, it is both.
Yeah.
And it can take its toll depending on the nature of a given case on a given day and what's going on in your own life.
Right. Then there's the actual work. And again, we don't want to go into too much, but I alluded to it. It's just not pretty. I mean, we're reading about, a foam that seeps out. It's caused by opioids or brains that are distended or just the youth. Does the actual work itself, has that taken a toll? I mean, seeing so many young lives.
It seems like a simple question, but it is quite complex. The privilege, as you used that term, of actually being able to look inside of that amazing machine that is the human body and try to sort out what has happened to that particular individual is a privilege beyond measure. And at the same time, it's scientifically and intellectually exceedingly stimulating. Mm. On the other hand, as you enter that next season of your forensic life, then you start asking those bigger questions. How have I contributed? Am I simply cataloging the horrors of interpersonal violence or self-abuse or self-neglect? How have I contributed to the public health's improvement in some way? And I know we do. It's all tremendously important work, but it is taxing on one's soul.
And as you've watched the epidemic go from, heroin to fentanyl to carfentanil, the elephant tranquilizer, it's gotten exponentially worse, and it doesn't feel as if there's been a response to it.
That is a part of some of the frustration, to have seen this develop right before our eyes. As early as 2004, 2005, we were identifying clear-cut trends in increased deaths due to opioids, but at that time, the culprit was prescription opioids. At least some subset of them went on to become habituated to their opiates, and as they became medical orphans, so to speak, they were fired by their medical practices for abusing their opiates or using their opiates inappropriately, started to try and get them illicitly from street vendors, and that obviously led to exposure to heroin, which was much cheaper. And then heroin gave way to fentanyl and its analogs, and now we are seeing not 100 or 200 drug deaths a year, we're seeing 500, and we don't see any end in sight.
Mm. The New York Times reports that in Ohio, some medical examiners store corpses in cold storage trailers in their parking lots. In Florida, they hire private body transport services to drive them somewhere else. But you started to say that you start thinking in this season about the bigger questions.
Well, I certainly don't want to give the impression that I was driven from this office by the opioid crisis. As a matter of fact, I told Dr. Duval when she was first hired 15 years ago to please be aware that I was going to retire in September of 2017. After that amount of time under the same leadership, things can become stale. You may be looking at things the same old way. Now, that being said, The opioid crisis certainly didn't make it difficult to leave either. You know, it does mount because of the way it has changed one's practice. You have this, you know, rather stimulating mix of cases, but then it becomes dominated by this one type of case, and that's what gets those wheels turning about, what am I contributing here? What kind of difference does this make? The point is, it sharpens the call. You realize you've got X amount of gas left in the tank, and either I could choose to limp through this another 10 years and see where this goes on the accounting end, or I could finally attack this by way of extension ministry to youth outside the four walls of a church. If you can instill moral and ethical values in young people that can somehow help to inoculate them from that other so-called friend of theirs who's going to come up to them in middle school with the weed or the pill or heaven forbid, that packet of powder, then you have maybe, you know, saved that one starfish off the beach.
So we understand you're going to become an ordained deacon in the United Methodist Church to serve the Boy Scouts of America as a chaplain, but also to serve hikers?
The United Methodist Church has a ministry on the Appalachian Trail. The AT runs through 11 different United Methodist conferences, and one of those conferences has a ministry that is called the Appalachian Trail Chaplaincy. I'm very much interested in throwing my hat into that particular ring. So many people are on that trail trying to chase demons, and what you are is a quiet, gentle presence there, a safe place for that person to try and process these things that are haunting them so.
Dr. Thomas Andrew, again, he's going to be retiring as chief medical examiner in New Hampshire and will enroll in divinity school. You could have gone fishing.
Could have, but I'm a lousy fisherman. I can't play golf. I can hike decently, but this is what I want to do.
Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Senate and House Intelligence Committee members are holding hearings today to ask Facebook, Twitter, and Google executives to explain how Russians were able to use social media sites to influence the 2016 U.S. election. In a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday, Senator Al Franken sounded incredulous when he asked Facebook counsel Colin Stretch how his company didn't see Russian interference.
You can't put together rubles with a political ad and go like, those two data points spell out something bad.
Senator, it's a signal we should have been alert to, and in hindsight, it's one we missed.
Okay, yeah.
Well, fake Facebook and Twitter profiles designed to try to sway elections came as no surprise to teenagers who regularly use alternate accounts, particularly on Instagram. Youth Radio asked four teens to explain.
My name is Malia Disney, and I'm 17 years old. Teens have different social media accounts for, like, a lot of reasons, one of which is that there's, like, kind of a fear that colleges will look at their social media accounts and see images of them, like, not doing exactly what teenagers should be doing. So, like, teens have two separate Instagram accounts, the Rinsta and the Finsta. Rinsta being their real Instagram, where they let anybody follow, or, like, most people follow. Your Finsta is where you let, like, very close friends follow, and they see photos of you doing things that are like, aha, I hate school, or, like, making kind of, like, inappropriate jokes, being like, haha, like, I hate my life. Seeing fake accounts on Instagram specifically isn't really, like, a major worry of mine in terms of, like, the other political issues going on right now, and it's also, at least in my experience, people who tend to, like, fall for that are on Facebook, and they tend to be more of an older generation who don't have much, like, tech literacy.
Hello, my name is Sayer Brown Valancourt, and I'm 16 years old. Yes, I've always known there are fake social personas out there because, like, my generation, we kind of grew up with this technology. It was generation before me that was fooled and misled by this. I mean, especially if you're a teenager, there's always going to be, like, your account that, like, you're allowed, quote unquote, allowed to have. And then there's the one that, you know, necessarily you may not want your parents to know.
Hi, I'm Arnav Gupta and I'm 17 years old. I think that it might start to become even more common that teens have many accounts, mostly because a lot of the older generations, like my parents, are starting to get on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes you don't want them to see those kinds of things because they're relatively personal to you and your friends' lives. So I think people having multiple accounts is pretty vital to keeping those two facets of life separate.
I'm Sierra Fong Horvath, and I'm 17 years old. Lack of awareness of the parallel between us and our Finstas and whatever other spam accounts we have, whether it's like Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, whatever. There's very little connection in our minds between those and then this like really high risk, like big consequence fake account stuff that's going on with Russia. Like, we don't draw that parallel, but I do see how it's there, which makes it a little comfortable because it's weird to think there's a Russian person sitting somewhere, you know, trying to influence my life. But in effect, I'm kind of doing that too with my fake account, I guess. No, it's a weird thing.
Four teens on their many lives on social media. Their thoughts brought to us from Youth Radio.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Chris Doritas is a DJ with KCRW. He's back with us today from Santa Monica, California. Hi, Chris.
Jeremy, always good to be with you. How are you?
I'm doing well, and let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is the band The Neighborhood with their song Roll Call.
Just run that race, little soldier. No one's gonna win anytime soon. Just know your role, little soldier. Don't get left behind.
Interesting song there with kind of a slow, creepy sound and some auto-tuned vocals.
You know, you wouldn't know it to listen to them that they're actually a band from Los Angeles.
Because their name is The Neighborhood, but they spell it the European way, so you definitely wouldn't know they're from California, right?
Yeah, they did that to distinguish themselves from another band called The Neighborhood. I mean, they're from the Valley. They're from Conejo Valley outside of Los Angeles. This EP called the Hard EP, it just dropped out of nowhere. We weren't expecting this. And it, like you said, it has this really eerie, you know, bold mixing technique. I dig that about this track.
And The Neighborhood, with an OU, is not necessarily a band that our listeners have heard of. Do they have other stuff that you like?
Oh, yeah. You know, they had a big, big hit with a track called Sweater Weather some years ago. So I think a lot of the audience might be familiar with that track, but this is definitely a departure.
Okay, well, the next one you wanted us to hear is called Concrete. This is by the UK punk band Shame.
Do you feel alone?
Well, sometimes I do.
Do you feel a place?
Feel like there's nothing at all.
Fear in the unknown.
Stand into the abyss.
Craving an escape.
Waiting for the call.
The lyrics coming too fast for me to figure out, Chris. What are they singing about there?
well, they're this very cool post-punk band out of South London. They got a lot of attention at South by Southwest this past year. And this is their new single. They've only had four songs out so far, but this one we're seeing this crazy growth with their production. The song is massive. It's in your face. It's confrontational. In terms of the lyric content, I mean, it's... I think it's relationship driven, just a lot of angst in a challenging relationship that the lead singer was going through.
Have you always been a punk fan?
Not at all. That was a big hole in my life musically. I was never a punk fan, really.
But now? Still not a punk fan?
I think it's so invigorating to hear a song like this come through, because there's so many kind of shoegazing, introspective singer-songwriter records coming at us these days, that when something comes like this and bursts through and it's of a quality, it's really exhilarating.
Okay, let's change gears now and hear from the electronic music duo Odessa. This is Across the Room featuring soul singer Leon Bridges.
Your friends are calling you, baby, stay with me instead. I know you're saying that you're tired, there's a door dancing in your left. Even if I go, I still think of you in my bed. Of a good time, good time. Time we had.
What a great voice.
Yeah. You know, it's a electronic duo from Seattle, Harrison Mills, Clayton Knight. They, you know, since they don't have vocals of their own, they're apt to bring in guest vocalists. On this new album, A Moment Apart, they've got Regina Spektor as a guest, and in this case, it's Leon Bridges. I love the way that Leon's voice grounds this track with a gravitas, you know, and they have this electronic backing track, but then they hand us off to this really big, sampled, gospel-flavored chorus. This is the band's third album. It's really great throughout. It's astonishing to me to think that they formed like 5 years ago, and 4 years ago they were playing like tiny club shows around the country, and now they're headlining arenas.
And it's so great that these bands do these collaborations like this. Is that common to see a band like Odessa get together with Leon Bridges?
Well, I think that now that anybody can make a record in their bedroom, if they don't have a talent at singing or doing vocals, then they're going to process those vocals, or they're going to use sampled vocals, or they're going to bring in a guest artist, like M83 does.
All right, well, up next we have the song Motion Sickness. This is by the L.A.-based singer-songwriter Phoebe Bridgers.
You gave me $1,500 to see your
a nice sound. Tell us about Phoebe Bridgers.
You know, her voice has this melancholic lump in the throat that gives her music this emotional charge for me. She's another LA-based artist. She's a graduate of LOXHA, which is the LA County High School for the Arts here. And we've been following her since her first demos. It's really an intimate outing, her debut, which is called Strangers in the Alps. It just came out this past week, and she brings this, I don't know, this coy and confessional turns of phrase to her songwriting. And her first single, which came out a few months ago, was the first song that was about David Bowie's death, the death of David Bowie. And I really gravitated to that song, and I suggest people check that one out. But this one is just a solid rocker, and it takes you on this really good ride.
Well, we have time for one more today, and this is going to be Love Me Like I'm Gone by Jaws of Love. Let's listen.
I'm always thinking of you when I'm up this high. I see me at your funeral. I see you at mine. I get embarrassed and rub my eyes. this always happens every flight. I see the plane going down, counting the seconds of my life. I want you to love me like I'm gone.
Now, Jaws of Love has its roots in the band Local Natives. You can hear a similar vibe here. What do you like about this song?
Yeah, well, I love the voice of Kelsey Ayer, who is the lead singer of Local Natives, and this is his solo project. This song is so deeply personal. It's about him having this feeling of intense love for his wife, thoughts that come whenever he's taking a flight somewhere and hoping that he makes it to the destination. As a music supervisor, I was working on this Netflix series called Flaked with Will Arnett, and Kelsey invited us down to hear the album almost a year ago. And just after he played it for us, we were also moved by that song, and it's on this album that he's put out under the name Jaws of Love. It's called Tasha Sits Close to the Piano. Tasha's his dog.
It's Chris Derides, a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California, joining us with this week's DJ session. Chris, thank you.
Jeremy, always good to talk to you.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. Join 9,000 plus others. We're NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Jury selection is underway today in Las Vegas in the federal trial of Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and his sons. Now, you might remember the Bundy sons were acquitted last year in a completely separate case in which they were accused of preventing federal workers from accessing land at that wildlife refuge in Oregon. Today's case in Las Vegas is about the standoff 2 years earlier in 2014 when the elder Bundy and his sons led a standoff against federal agents who were trying to round up their cattle after Bundy refused to pay the grazing fees on federal lands. In this YouTube footage from 2014, you can hear some of the hundreds of people gathered at the site to protest in support of Bundy, many heavily armed. On the other side of the gate are federal officers and the cattle. Well, shortly after, the federal agent let the Bundys have their cattle, and you can hear the crowd's response. The yells there to the federal agents of go home. So what happened? Well, earlier this year, Nevada Judge Gloria Navarro said Cliven Bundy had to wait to go on trial on several charges from that day until after the retrial of four of his co-defendants. In August, two of them were acquitted. Jurors couldn't reach a verdict on the other two. Well, reporter Sadie Babbitts will be covering the trial that is now taking place in Las Vegas. And Sadie, we're hearing jury selection has been hard. This is, after all, Las Vegas. The case is about an armed standoff. It involves guns. And some of the jurors were close to that terrible massacre in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right. So jury selection continues today. It's expected to wrap up by the end of the week. They're going to be selecting 12 jurors and four alternates. And the jury pool is rather large. About 60 people have been summoned each day. This began on Monday. And this trial was actually supposed to begin early last month, but because of the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the defense pushed for the trial to be postponed until late October. The defense doesn't want a jury to be prejudiced about firearms, and so defense attorneys have been working pretty hard to keep the Bundys separate in the public eye from the gun violence that's happened since the standoff in 2014 in Nevada.
Well, and we understand some jurors tearing up when asked about how they feel about guns. One woman was at the Mandalay Bay Resort, felt she couldn't handle this case. And the Bundys are able to ask questions of the potential jurors, so that's been very dramatic. But take us back to when this took place in Bunkerville, Nevada. Cliven Bundy is sort of the poster man for grazing rights, a long history of not paying the fees or getting permits for his cattle on federal lands. He's racked up millions of dollars. He called in armed supporters to support him when the federal agents came to take the cattle. Tell us more about his reasoning.
So that's right. You know, there's been a lot of litigation over the years to get Cliven Bundy to pay for those grazing fees to the Bureau of Land Management or remove his cattle, and Bundy has refused. Now, most ranchers will pay these grazing fees, which are below market value, and move on, but not Bundy. Now, I spoke with Charles Wilkinson. He's a distinguished law professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder and an expert on public land law.
He's the last vestige of the real old-time setting in the mud Western ranchers.
Wilkinson says Cliven Bundy believes that the government has no right to require him to pay a fee or a permit. Cliven Bundy has said all along, this really hasn't been about these grazing fees. This is about state sovereignty and who has access and control of public lands. Really comes down to constitutional freedoms for him and the fact that, you know, the Bundy family has said that their ancestors were some of the first Mormon settlers of Bunkerville, Nevada back in 1877, and they have a right and authority to be on this land and graze their cattle. Now, the federal government, let's be clear here, they have the authority to manage these public lands, and this is something that the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld.
Yeah. Well, and we remember that the Bureau of Land Management decided to let the Bundys have their cattle on that day. You can see footage. No one arrested then, no shots ever fired. But then Cliven Bundy actually arrested in 2016, going forward again to the event where his sons took over the wildlife refuge, and they were acquitted in that case. Now they're all on trial in this 2014 event, the cattle standoff. We understand 85% of the land is controlled by federal government in Nevada, where this is taking place. Big issue there. What exactly are the charges against Cliven Bundy?
Yes, so public land obviously is a huge part of Nevada, and Bundy is facing a number of charges, including assault on a federal law enforcement officer, using and carrying a firearm in relation to a crime of violence, obstruction of administration of justice, and interference with commerce by extortion. He could face many, many years behind bars and thousands of dollars in fines.
Sadie Babbitts is a Ted Scripps Environmental Journalism Fellow at the University of Colorado in Boulder, researching and reporting on tensions over public lands in the West. She will be front and center at the Bundy trial as it gets underway. Sadie, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And of course, we'll follow the Bundy trial in Las Vegas. And today, we're following any news out of yesterday's terrorist truck attack in New York all day, including later today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.